Pavlik, and good afternoon to you all. Just like to take a moment to sort of reinforce or back up, but just a personal observation with the reference to the death of Linda Angelou. We did not know them a long time, in one sense. We have some friends we've had in the church for decades. We didn't find that to be with them, but it was as if once we actually met and talked and just got to know each other, it was, in one sense, it was a kind of an unusual arrangement. Here he is, a Frenchman from Paris with a Dutch name, and she was from the same area of the country that I was from, southwest Missouri. I grew up in Springfield after my family moved from St. Louis. Did not know her before because she was in the military at that time. As you probably read in the announcement, she had served as a young woman before she came in God's church. So we didn't know each other from that vantage point, but it, I don't know, there was something about it. Every time we would go down to teach at FI in Texas, we could be sure there would be an invitation to come over for dinner. And various members of the family would do the cooking, and whenever he did, it was all French specialties from French cuisine in Paris, which my wife speaks some French, and I think she eats in French too sometimes. But at any rate, it seemed to go over very well. So I had the chance to spend an hour or two with him less than 2 weeks before he died. I was down for international meetings just before he died last year, not for FI, so my wife was not with me. We had a chance to spend some time together and just talk, just two friends. And so it was... it was just a moment, touching moment. We knew she was struggling too, health-wise, but we just have felt very, very close to the couple, so it's something that touches us very deeply. Please do seek out Mrs. Hughes. I believe she's the one who has the card for the congregation to sign, so if you don't find her, she will come find you. So just know that. Thank you for your concern. I've not met the oldest child, Sarah, but I've met the other four. We know the younger three quite well. And it's a family that finds itself, as Mr. Burnett said in his announcement, kind of in some ways in shock. It's not unexpected, but it doesn't really matter. My wife and I discovered years ago that when you lose your last parent, it doesn't really matter how old you are orphans and you feel it. And that's something that we can all, I think, relate to. Many of us can. Well, shifting gears, I don't want to, in that sense, dwell on that, but shifting gears a little bit, we are, as we all know, approaching what is for us one of the most important seasons of the year, the fall Holy Day season. It starts now in just under 4 weeks, because the trumpets is the Thursday night, as we heard in the announcement, Thursday night, the 3rd of October. That's just a tad under 4 weeks away now. Even though the days are later on the Roman calendar, one of the years, I think it's probably about 10, 11 years ago, I think it was 2013, the days of the week fell on the same numbering that they do this year, but by this Sabbath of September 7th in that year, we had already kept the Feast of Trumpets 2 days before. Everything was so early back in 2013. It was all in September. But this year, it's all in October. In this season, as you know, we all anticipate, again, the return of Jesus Christ and the resurrection of the righteous, those who are the dead in Christ and those who will be changed, who are His at His coming. We understand the picture of that festival that we keep at the first of the four fall festivals. Then it's followed by the Day of Atonement, picturing the binding of Satan, enabling the entire world to finally... to use a play on one that play on words at least that works in English, to be at one with God. Then the millennial reign of Christ with the saints follows very quickly, 5 days later, and the great second resurrection to give an opportunity for salvation to the uncounted billions who have lived and died without that chance, as God determines that chance, whether or not they had the opportunity to understand. Some may have come in contact with the truth, may have even adopted certain elements of it, but never fully grasped, and never in God's eyes, as He will decide, have had their opportunity for salvation. And of course, The eighth day also includes a kind of a spinning out to fullness and fruition of God's whole plan. But to the world around us, it's just fall. I commented to my wife, I was looking at the display here in the front of fall colors. And it certainly suddenly feels like fall. We had at one point considered having a picnic at our house, inviting you all over, but we didn't have enough parkas to hand out. Or, you know, raincoats. Earlier in the week, it looked like that was going to be the issue. And it did rain, at least here, pretty much all day yesterday. We would have had no chance to set up, and we would have all been shivering. And I'm sure we'd have had all, whoever came would have been saying, "Can we please go in your house?" So that may have been the best call to make. Another time. Of course, this approaching season will see all of us listening, we hope that's true, to many sermons. We'll be focusing very differently than the world around us. This season actually holds, and we've been seeing it for weeks and weeks already in the stores, I will just say it holds my wife's most despised pagan holiday on the calendar year. It comes in this season of the year, tail end of October. This is the season, one of them, that sees the contrast between our beliefs and our understanding and the world around us. The sermons you'll hear will be geared especially to this time of year and pointing to those great events yet ahead of us. I just have a question, and I want to come at things from a little different angle today. In some ways, it'll be more like a Bible study approach, but that's, I hope, helpful from time to time. What if you went to the Feast of Tabernacles at whatever site you're going to go to, and you looked at the list of speakers for the services, and it said, on the first holy day and on the last holy day, the person giving the sermon was Jesus Christ. What if we could hear him actually give one of those sermons? I have a feeling if he were at one of the feast sites, all the other fellows on the speaking schedule would say, "Can we just sit down, please, and let him do them all?" But actually, as you surely know, we do have a sermon that he gave. Well, not technically a sermon. We have the notes from the sermon, as recorded by Matthew, and to some degree Mark and Luke, but especially by Matthew. Now, since he was a tax collector, we have to trust him to have gotten the details correct. I don't think too many people who work with tax preparation or collection are sloppy on details. I think they probably have the details pretty well down. That one sermon, the Sermon on the Mount, of course, we call it, has intrigued a lot of people for a lot of years. It's been quoted, and its central early theme of the Beatitudes has been needle-pointed, hung in picture frames. It has been scoffed at by some and used as a list of virtues by others. But have we ever considered the Beatitudes themselves in what I will call a progressive sense? Have you ever looked at the Beatitudes as building on the qualities that are listed? In a way, it's similar to the progression of the fall holy days. The Feast of Trumpets points us to the return of Christ and the resurrection of the righteous. The Day of Atonement sees the binding of Satan to stifle and throttle at its core the source of all the foul attitudes and approaches and wrong-headed thinking that has so sent our world careening off course. And then the Feast of Tabernacles, picturing the 1,000-year millennial reign of Jesus Christ and the saints. A time with qualities and characteristics and conditions that would not have been possible had not Christ put down all rebellion and had not Satan been bound. to restrain his influences, to end his influence. Doesn't mean that suddenly everyone will be perfect and there will never be any problems whatsoever, because we will still be dealing with human beings. But it will be a vastly different world. Of course, we know that it won't have totally removed the problem, because we're informed in the book of Revelation that Satan must be released for a short season at the end of the millennium. And in just a short amount of time, a massive amount of population of the planet turns again against God. Almost incomprehensible. And then follows the eighth day, or the last great day, we've traditionally called it, the time when those essentially who have never understood suddenly have the scales fall from their eyes and can see. They can see what they never could see before. I suspect a number here have had the experience, especially if you came to the church as, let's say, late teenager or into your adult years, of being so filled with excitement of what you were learning that you tried to convince those closest to you of it, and you were just certain they would understand. And then you were maybe shocked when it didn't happen quite that way. Those are all things that we think of as we look at the fall holy days. There is a progression. We move from one step to the other. What about the Beatitudes in the same way? What about looking at them in the same way, in a sense that might help us even understand some of the challenges we face as God's people, among them developing patience, as we heard today earlier? A progression that can even help us along the path pictured by the fall holy days, along the path of our calling. What we want to think about today is, where does this segment of that Sermon on the Mount start? Where does it move? And where does it end up? Are there things there that Jesus Christ has to say to his beloved disciples of all ages, including you and me? Well, first of all, as we look at the first two verses of Matthew chapter 5, it's clear that Jesus had something to pass on to his disciples, something to pass on to us. Look at the first two verses. Seeing the multitudes, he went up on a mountain, and when he was seated, his disciples came to him. So that's the first thing we find out. He was not speaking initially to the crowds. He was on a mountain. He went up on the mountain. It's like he was trying to get away from the crowds. On our tour of Israel more than 5 years ago, we were taken to a place they traditionally there call the Mount of the Beatitudes. I suppose in some ways we don't know for certain. We saw some camels. I didn't see too much else. Well, and just a lot of dirt and brown stuff. But that's traditionally the site it's thought to have been. But he went up on a mountain, he was seated, and his disciples came to him. See the progression of events? So when he's sitting down, I'm sure they sat down and just waited to see what he would say. Then he opened his mouth and taught them, saying, and here come the passages, the words that we're so familiar with. He actually went up into the mountain apparently to get away from the masses of people. It's not that his message wouldn't do them any good. It could help anyone. But his purpose was to teach his disciples. Now it's clear from looking at some of the verses just in this chapter alone that he holds out high expectations for the special called out ones, the ones that he has opened minds in. Look at verses 13 and 14, for example. You are the salt of the earth. But if the salt loses its flavor, how shall it be seasoned? It's then good for nothing but to be thrown out and trampled underfoot by men. You are the light of the world. A city set on a hill can't be hidden. They don't light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on a lampstand, and it gives light to all who are in the house. Interesting reference there, all in the house. Is there even a kind of a double meaning to that? The house of God? Is it the ones in the house, in the church, in the calling that see it better than anything else? Maybe. What about verse 20? I say to you that unless your righteousness exceeds the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees. And remember, their view of the scribes and Pharisees' righteousness then was a pretty high order, because they couldn't see the hypocrisy involved in it. You will by no means enter the kingdom of heaven. A reference to ownership, not geography. Verse 44. I say to you, love your enemies. What? That doesn't make sense in a human way of looking at things. We don't think about it that way humanly. People talk about, you know, I get even with my enemies. I do one better. But he says, bless those who curse you. Do good to those who hate you. Pray for those who spitefully use you and persecute you. Verse 48, therefore you shall be perfect, even as your Father, or just as your Father in heaven is perfect. That's a goal. That's a target to aim for. Pretty high expectations, pretty high standards. It's also clear that the message itself was important. As the Sermon on the Mount ends, we find these verses at the tail end of chapter 7, verse 24 of chapter 7. Therefore, whoever hears these sayings of mine and does them, I will liken him to a wise man who built his house on the rock. Here's a metaphor. Look how closely the two parts of it parallel each other. And the rain descended, the floods came, the winds blew and beat on that house, and it did not fall, for it was founded on the rock. But everyone who hears these sayings of mine and does not do them will be like a foolish man who built his house on the sand. Same trials of life. The rain descended, the floods came, the wind blew and beat on the house, it fell. Great was its fall. Now we do notice a little tag end here that's kind of interesting. Apparently, sometime during his speaking, crowds found him. Because it says, so it was when Jesus had ended these things that the people were astonished at his teaching. Not the disciples, the people. For he taught them as one having authority, not as the scribes. So it's an interesting scenario altogether. But let's focus on one part today. These people, we were told in the very first verse of chapter 8, when he had come down from the mountain, great multitudes followed him. Suddenly, the multitudes came out of somewhere. Now they want to go with him. But let's focus today on that one part, the famous Beatitudes, early in chapter 5. Where do they start? Where do they go? Where do they end up? Is it possible they are some kind of progression? You know, God does that sometimes. I've already mentioned the pattern of the holy days, especially the fall festivals. We're certainly thinking about that at this time of year. Tomorrow, we find we'll be starting to count down even more rapidly, I think. Maybe you kind of count weekends. Well, you go from Sabbath to Sabbath, or starting another week to starting another week. We just continue that countdown. We're less than 4 weeks from trumpets. We know, of course, what this season of the year usually means. For another example of progression, take a look, hold your place in Matthew 5. I use the ribbon, one ribbon my Bible has, because I know I'm going to come back there. So you can't say I didn't give fair warning today. Hold your spot, Matthew 5. But look at 2 Peter chapter 1. Mr. Henderson was in 2 Peter for a while today as well. 2 Peter chapter 1. And pick it up in verse 5. For this very reason, the reason of escaping the corruption in the world through lust, verse 4, giving all diligence, add to your faith virtue. Look at this progression. To virtue, knowledge. To knowledge, self-control. To self-control, perseverance. To perseverance, godliness. To godliness, brotherly kindness. And to brotherly kindness, love. And then there's a result. If these things are yours and abound, you will not be barren or unfruitful in the knowledge of our Lord Jesus Christ. And he gives a bit of a warning. The one who lacks these things is short-sighted even to blindness. That's really short-sighted. And has forgotten that he was cleansed from his old sins, which is the starting point for everything. So there's a progression. It follows the context of the promises of our calling from the first four verses, the need Peter felt to issue reminders, as he said a few verses later in verses 12 and 13. So he works in a progression to help. There's another place not far away in James chapter 3. James is talking about some of the problems. In this case, one of the problems he addresses is bitterness and envy in verse 14 of chapter 3. And he contrasts the world's wisdom and godly wisdom. And he says in verse 17, he says, the wisdom that is from above is first pure. There's a progression. There's a beginning place. And then it's peaceable. It's gentle. It's willing to yield. Full of mercy and good fruits. That could be considered, I suppose, one or two, or just full of mercy and good fruits. Without partiality and without hypocrisy. If you count mercy and good fruits as one, there are seven. And there's a list in Proverbs 9:1 of elements of wisdom. Who knows? Maybe those intended to match. And he talks about the fruit of righteousness is sown in peace by those who make peace. Now that word is going to echo in the Beatitudes, but we'll get there in a minute. Here's another one. Psalm chapter 1. Again, you of course have planted one of your fingers in Matthew 5. Don't run out of fingers, please. Psalm chapter 1, verse 1. Blessed is the man who walks not in the counsel of the ungodly, nor stands in the path of sinners, nor sits in the seat of the scornful. Here's a progression, but in the wrong direction. He says, you're blessed if you don't get caught in this descending, trapping progression. You don't walk after the advice or counsel of ungodly people. Now, if you're walking along and you just take a better, you want to look at something more closely, nor do you stand in the path of sinners. You're walking along, you see something, and you stop and say, I want to learn more about that. Now you've stopped. And then it says, nor do you sit in the seat of the scornful. Walk, stand, sit. More and more entrenched in a bad pattern. So it can work in reverse. Did you catch in the sermonette a progression? I won't ask Mr. Henderson if he caught the progression, because I'm sure he did. But in Romans chapter 5, where he went, there was a progression. Romans 5, he talks about glorying in verse 3. Not only that, these other items he mentioned, the first two verses, but we also glory in tribulations, or, as he pointed out, could be translated afflictions. Knowing what? Knowing that tribulation produces perseverance. Perseverance, character. And character, hope. Another progression. We weren't in cahoots. I didn't know what he was going to talk about. We had a little agreement before. We wouldn't speak heresy today. But other than that, we didn't talk about it. But I caught that, my ear perked up and said, aha, got out my pen, started scribbling. A progression. So, let's go back to Matthew 5 and the Beatitudes. Let's take a look. What's first? Well, first of all, I would like to look at the outcomes that are listed. You ever studied that sort of technique of, let's say, management or just working through business plans and so on? You plan for outcomes. What is it you hope to attain? What is your goal? It works in building character and living God's way too. What are the outcomes of the Beatitudes? Well, there are eight of them. The last two, you could say nine, but the last two are simply a restatement. There are eight outcomes. First of all, theirs is the kingdom of heaven. That's an outcome. Secondly, they shall be comforted. That's an outcome. Then they shall inherit the earth. The third one. Number four, they shall be filled. Number five, they shall obtain mercy. Number six, they shall see God. Number seven, they shall be called sons of God. Number eight is reworded, but it's essentially the same thing. Theirs is the kingdom of heaven, and great is your reward in heaven. Doesn't mean we're going to heaven to get it. This is not the time to explain that. I'm sure we all understand the concept. Jesus Christ brings his reward with him at his return. So really, those last two things are just a restatement, same thing. Eight outcomes. Those statements sound pretty good, don't they? Wouldn't we all like to have those outcomes? Well, again, I'll borrow a page from the sermonette. You want patience? You heard the story about the pastor praying for patience for the man. Do you want these outcomes? What will you ask for then? What will you do? What will your choices be? How will you live in order to receive these outcomes? What if they build on one another? What if we look at it as a goal to reach? In this case, to be so filled with God's Spirit and His ways that at the far end of these comparisons, we would even become peacemakers, and then even if that's what it required, we would be willing to suffer affliction, trials, persecution for God's sake, and not turn aside. Well, let's look now at the steps to the goal. Let's backtrack and find out what the preliminaries are to the outcomes, because those are really the Beatitudes. That's where the phrasing comes from. Blessed are, etc., etc., etc. So what's the first one? Blessed are the poor in spirit. Progression for action. Number one, what does it mean? Well, it means, if we translate it from the Greek words, the Greek word involved, it means poor. The word that is used, I'm not going to go into detail on the Greek words. I'm not sure that that's particularly useful for us today. But let me just state that this Greek word appears 34 times in the King James. The references I had were based on the Authorized Version or the King James. 34 times. The Greek word appears 30 times in the King James. It's translated poor. Twice it's translated beggar. Once it's translated poor man. Once it's translated beggarly. 34 times. So it means that it's somebody who is destitute of wealth or influence or position or honor. It can mean lowly or afflicted. It can mean helpless or powerless to accomplish an end. Poor, needy, lacking anything. There are references. There are metaphorical references. Poor in spirit, of course, seems to be a metaphor all by itself. It's an approach and an outlook of mind. Does that remind you of anything scripturally? Well, it reminded me of a verse we're probably all familiar with in Isaiah 66 and verse 2. After God makes the comparison of how he lives and how we live, he says, "Heaven's my throne, earth is my footstool. Where's the house you'll build me? Where's the place of my rest?" And then verse 2 of Isaiah 66, "All those things my hand has made. All those things exist. But on this one will I look, on him who is poor and of a contrite spirit and who trembles at my word." That's what we're being asked to do in order to have the result. Theirs is the kingdom. It belongs to heaven. It's coming here. Are you and I poor in spirit in those terms? Because that's the preliminary step. That's the place to start. That's all about our approach to God in the very first place. Again, a reference might be helpful. James chapter 4. James 4. Beginning in verse 6, it says, "He gives more grace. Therefore," he says, "God resists the proud, but gives grace to the humble." That's a reference from the book of Proverbs, chapter 3, actually, 3:34 Proverbs. But it very closely resembles Isaiah 66, 2. "Therefore, submit to God, resist the devil, and he will flee from you. Draw near to God and he will draw near to you. Cleanse your hands, you sinners. Purify your hearts, you double-minded. Lament, mourn, weep. Let your laughter be turned to mourning and your joy to gloom. Humble yourselves in the sight of the Lord and he will lift you up. And in those words, James actually foreshadows the second of the Beatitudes. So let's go back to Matthew chapter 5. Matthew 5 and verse 4 picks up the trail from James. But is it possible that one leads to the next? That approaching God in this way, being poor of spirit, gives meaning in difficult times, because it says, blessed are those who mourn. I made the comments that I did about the Angelou family in part because of the connection to this sermon. My wife and I were both very touched by the news. First of Bernard's death last November, and then just a week or so ago from Linda. There is a sense of loss. For us lately, in the last month, we've lost about 5 or 6 people we were close to. And that's hard. There were 4 young men at Pasadena Ambassador College in the fall of 1969. 4 young men who became extremely close. I was one of them. The first of us is gone in the last 2 weeks. 1 down, 3 to go. My first assignment in the ministry was in the Philippines. As a 20-year-old student, having finished 3 years, my mentor, the pastor I worked for, was Colin Adair. Colin Adair died 26 years ago from leukemia, much too young. 2 weeks ago, his widow died, Margaret Adair. We've been in touch a little bit, had been a while. And the list goes on. Sometimes it just builds up. Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. What does that mean to you? Well, mourning means, the literal translation, 10 times in the New Testament, 7 times mourn, twice it's translated wail, and once bewail in the Authorized Version. To mourn for. What do you and I lament in this world? A little further in the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus assured his disciples in chapter 6 of something very personal to them. Very personal to them. He talked about the concept of some of the things they would have to deal with. They were not aware. He warned them even in their prayers to pray for deliverance from some of these things. But later on in John chapter 16, when he was speaking to them just before his death, he pointed out something they couldn't understand then. He said in verse 19 of John 16, are you asking among yourselves about what I said a little while and you won't see me, and again a little while and you will? Assuredly, I say to you, you will weep and lament, but the world will rejoice. You will be sorrowful, but your sorrow will be turned to joy. A woman, when she's in labor, has sorrow because her hour has come. But as soon as she's given birth to the child, she no longer remembers the anguish for joy that a human being has been born into the world. Therefore, you now have sorrow, but I will see you again, and your heart will rejoice, and your joy no one will take from you. The last verse of chapter 16, he says, these things I've spoken to you, that in me you may have peace. That's an echo of the beatitude and the outcome. In the world you will have tribulation, but be of good cheer, because I've overcome the world. So the second of the Beatitudes is blessed are those who mourn. Not because it's a pleasant or happy thing, but because it's part of life. And when it happens with the knowledge of God, there's something different in our hearts and minds. We know what the outcome is. We are not left in doubt. That's pretty special. Now, I know this reference to John is something that was very specific to his disciples back then, but doesn't it apply in a broader sense that we too have moments of mourning? And as on a broad vein, don't we also mourn and sorrow at the apparent success for now of God's greatest archenemy? But we know that when Christ is sent back to this earth by the Father, that Satan will eventually no longer hold sway over this world. Do we rejoice over that? Isn't that comforting? It's one of the reasons why, for me, the Day of Atonement is one of my favorite holy days. I'm not, you know, a big fan of going hungry, but that's not really the point of the day. That's just something that comes along with it. Remember those words Jesus Christ said, "I have overcome the world." Because I would ask a question, who else is supposed to? Who else? Well, let's go on to the next beatitude, the third one. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. This particular specific Greek word doesn't appear that many times, only three times in the New Testament, and it's always translated meek in the Authorized Version. It means a gentleness of spirit. One definition, which I found in one of the reference works I looked up, one of the lexicons, said that meekness toward God is that disposition of spirit in which we accept his dealings with us as good. Therefore, without disputing or resisting. That's not always easy to do. That's not always easy to do. Again, reference to the sermonette. God, give me patience and give it to me right now. Do we accept his dealings with us as good and do not dispute it? It's hard to do. Later on, it says, the same source, gentleness or meekness is the opposite of self-assertiveness and self-interest. It stems from trust in God's goodness and control over the situation. Those are the things we have to think about. Those words are a mouthful. It means accepting Romans 8:28 as true. I'm very familiar with that verse. It's not chiseled out word for word, but the reference is on my dad's tombstone in Redding, California, where he died 32 years ago today. He had 32 years in God's church. I've now doubled that. 64 years. And that's what's chiseled in the marker over his grave. Romans 8:28. We may not understand how it is true, but we must accept that it is. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. That's the goal. That's the goal. It leads to inheriting what God intends for his children. Beatitude number four. I guess we could say 4A and 4B. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst. It's a two-parter, double-barreled. For righteousness, hunger and thirst for righteousness. The word for hunger means hunger. 23 times it appears in the New Testament. It can be translated hunger, hungry, be hungry, and hungered in the old way of putting it in the Authorized Version. To suffer want, to be needy. Metaphorically, to crave ardently, to seek with desire. Thirsty appears 16 times in the New Testament. Thirst. Thirst 10 times, be thirsty 3 times, be athirst 3 times. It means to suffer from thirst. Those figuratively who are said to thirst painfully feel their want of and long for the things by which the soul is refreshed. Again, it's a mouthful. That comes after we're meek, after we are willing to accept God's dealings with us as good. Then what drives us with a level of physical craving, like hunger and thirst would do, would be righteousness. What we really seek, what we really want, is righteousness. We accept God's direction in our lives, knowing that Romans 8:28 applies in some ways we can't always see. I remember at one turning point in our life, my wife and I were trying to puzzle out the next step that was happening. We couldn't really grasp it at the time. I remember saying to her, and she echoed it, I said, "I know Romans 8:28 is in here somewhere. I just can't see it yet." And she said, "I feel the same way." So those things are part of our lives, brethren. This is another step. It doesn't mean that everything that happens to us is wonderful. Again, using the Phillips translation, Mr. Henderson cited, Romans 8:28 says, it says, everything fits into a pattern for good. Fits into a pattern for good. The question is, what do we fill ourselves with? What nourishes us spiritually? And then, what happens in our lives as a result? We know that we have to look to God to fill us. Take a look at Philippians chapter 4. Philippians chapter 4. How many times have you read this progression verse? Be anxious for nothing, verse 6, and everything by prayer and supplication with thanksgiving, let your requests be made known to God. The peace of God, which passes all understanding, will guard your hearts and minds through Jesus Christ. And the peace of God, finally, brethren, whatever things are true, here we go with another progression, whatever things are noble, just, pure, lovely, of good report, if there's any virtue and there's anything praiseworthy, meditate on these things. Another progression. Verses 10 to 13, I rejoiced in the Lord greatly that now at last your care for me has flourished again. Though you surely did care, but you lacked opportunity, I don't speak in regard to need. I've learned in whatever state I am to be content. Have you reached that stage yet? I admit I'm still working on it. I know how to be abased and I know how to abound. Everywhere and in all things I've learned both to be full and to be hungry. Hungry. To abound, to suffer need, I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. Verse 19, my God shall supply all your need according to his riches and glory by Christ Jesus. Those are pretty deep verses. Quite a meaning in them. It says that those who hunger and thirst for righteousness will be filled. That was the outcome. It just means, that word in Greek means to be full, to fill, to satisfy, to feed. Sometimes it has definitions that actually make it sound like we're talking about a herd of sheep or a bunch of cows out munching on the hay. That's the graphic nature of the word. Once a person is truly filled with what only God can supply and which alone can really satisfy, then something happens. We can look with more favor on others. And there were overtones of that in the sermonette too. Remember the point about empathy? And we practice this godly quality. The thing is, brethren, our world engenders feelings of emptiness. But the problem is, most of those feelings of emptiness, people in the world cannot understand, are spiritual gaps. They are spiritual holes. Spiritual abysses and chasms. And the trick is, you cannot fill a spiritual hole with physical stuff. And too much in our world, people are trying to stuff the hole with physical things. Doesn't work. So let's go back to the Beatitudes, to number 5. Number 5 says, blessed are the merciful. It only appears, this specific Greek word, twice, but there's another one that's used that appears 31 times. So related words, 33 times. Means to have mercy on, can mean obtain mercy, have compassion, have pity on, have mercy upon, or receive mercy. It's all tied together. And it is in the Beatitude as well. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy. How do you and I feel toward others? Right here in the sermon, Jesus Christ says in chapter 6 what it's supposed to be. Verses 14 and 15, if you forgive men their trespasses, your heavenly Father will forgive you. But if you don't forgive men their trespasses, neither will your Father forgive yours. That's a kind of a quid pro quo that's pretty obvious. We need mercy. Blessed are the merciful, they shall obtain mercy. That's basically what chapter 6, verses 14 and 15 restate. Because when this happens, something else goes on. When we're truly merciful, and God has truly extended mercy to us, look at the next step. Beatitude number 6. Blessed are the pure in heart. The pure in heart. There are verses that exhort us to say, to the pure, all things are pure. That is, we don't go looking for bad stuff. Now, we shouldn't ignore it when it's in front of us. But we don't go looking for it or assuming the worst about others. Blessed are the pure. This word appears, katharos, appears 28 times. It means pure 17 times. It's translated clean 10 times, clear once. Sometimes it means purified by fire. Sometimes. It's sometimes there's an analogy of like a vine that's been cleansed by pruning. That can be used in the same sense as well. Morally and ethically, it can mean blameless or innocent, getting rid of corrupt desires, sin, or guilt. In other words, it means we can be forgiven before God. How do you and I feel about that? How much do we need that? Romans chapter 8. Verse 1, there is therefore now no condemnation to those who are in Christ Jesus, who do not walk according to the flesh, but according to the Spirit. For the law of the Spirit of life in Christ Jesus has made me free from the law of sin and death. We all sin. That's clear in other parts of Romans. But there is a method God has to remove the automatic enforcement of the penalty. And according to this beatitude, blessed are the pure in heart, they shall see God. How about 1 John 3? How many times have we read 1 John 3 in the first couple of verses? Very specific. John talks about what lies ahead and what you and I will one day experience. And in 1 John 3 verses 1 and 2, he says this, behold what manner of love the Father has bestowed on us, that we should be called children of God. Therefore the world does not know us because it did not know him. Beloved, now we are children of God. It has not yet been revealed what we shall be, but we know that when he's revealed, we shall be like him, for we shall see him as he is. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. Where does that take us? In our character, our approach, our usefulness to God, this progression we've been talking about. Now we come to number 7 in verse 9. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called sons of God. You know, in our rough and tumble American history, you know what was called a peacemaker, don't you? A Colt 45. Does that make peace? Well, they would have said back then it rids the world of varmints. But peacemaking? I don't think so. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called sons of God. When we have come through all this progression, through the first 6 stages, the first 6 beatitudes with 6 outcomes, we come to number 7 when it says, blessed are the peacemakers. What is God's nature? What does he want? Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called sons of God. It would be kind of hard before all those other traits are in place to become a peacemaker. If we hadn't learned how to be humble, poor in spirit, if we hadn't learned our need to be comforted by God's word and his beautiful plan, if we hadn't learned to be gentle and humble and meek and teachable, if we hadn't learned to place righteousness as a goal by hungry and thirsting for it like for food and water, before acknowledging our need to be forgiven, to be merciful ourselves so we could be, before being pure in heart. How could you be a peacemaker before those things came? Which of the Beatitudes we've seen would not be needed in the life of a peacemaker? Peacemaker appears one time in the New Testament. This specific word is only here. There are references that tie into it all along. It means someone who loves peace. Loves peace. That comes from loving God's way wholeheartedly. It's an ability imparted by His Spirit after we've had all those other things. It's the attitude of one who can be used in the way of Isaiah 30, verses 19, 20, and 21. In that day, you'll hear a word behind you in your ears saying, "This is the way. Walk in it." You want to be part of this kingdom? You want to be part of this family? Walk this way. Do these things. Live this way. Then we can be peacemakers. And then we get to the toughest step of all. If we are willing to be what it takes to be peacemakers, to be called the sons of God, then nothing can derail us from that goal. And then the last one comes up. Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake. And it's reworded in verse 11 slightly differently. Blessed are you when they revile and persecute you and say all kinds of evil against you falsely for my sake. The outcome, verse 10, double-barreled outcome, theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Verse 12, rejoice and be exceedingly glad, for great is your reward in heaven. For so they persecuted the prophets who were before you. Beatitude number 8, a willingness, if required, to undergo some fairly serious trials. The word for persecute appears 44 times, this Greek word. That's what it means most of the time. Sometimes it means to ensue or follow after. That's just what happens. There are other uses as well. To make, to run, or to flee. To put to flight, to drive away, to run swiftly, to catch a person. That's what's happening with those chasing. But it also refers to our willingness to live that way of life, to pursue God's righteousness. Blessed are you, persecuted for righteousness' sake. That word appears 92 times in the New Testament. 92 times. And then the outcome in our lives, rejoice and be exceeding glad. That word appears 74 times. So if we're persecuted for righteousness' sake, a word that appears 92 times, and if our response is the word that appears 74 times, that adds up to almost more than all the other words put together that I've said. It's quite a long list. Quite a long list. It's a challenge. This life is a challenge, isn't it? Sometimes, as we heard earlier today, we get impatient with ourselves and with others. Sometimes we just can't see why other people have some of the problems they do. Why can't they be more like me? Really? I'm not sure I would wish that on anybody. And we wonder. Christ was perfect. He had all the answers to some questions we haven't even thought to ask yet. And He knew what we would always, all of us, need, always. It's not easy. He didn't promise that it would be. Can we reach out to be guided and take the hand of the greatest peacemaker of all and trust Him to pull us through? You and I will very soon be entering a season when we can see and experience in foretaste and anticipate the way God's plan will play out and work out for all humanity. I've been thinking about that because I have 3 messages to prepare for the feast and one for 2 days later in the for the congregation in Montreal before we even come back home. Do we see its entire beauty and progression? Not just now, but at all times. Think about it. Are the Beatitudes of the Sermon on the Mount a guide to how you and I should embrace and joyfully observe and keep and long for the holy days and what they mean? Important question to ask and to answer, because, believe it or not, they will soon be here.